Hey everybody, this is Jeff from Good News Gathering. Thanks for joining us for this week's podcast based on the fourth book of the Bible, the book of Numbers. If you've been keeping up with the daily readings, you're nearing the end of the book of Numbers. It's an exciting book because after approximately a year spent at Mount Sinai, during which the infant Israelite nation received the law, now they are poised to move toward the land promised to their father Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12. Now the law was the foundation of both Israel's religious, or how they were to relate to God, and civil, how they relate to each other, order. It was the order under which this new nation would live. After seeing the miraculous acts of God and their deliverance from slavery in Egypt, and the manifestations of God's power and glory at Mount Sinai, this journey should have been filled with excitement and hope. Unfortunately, the book of Numbers is replete with heartbreaking failures. The book begins with a census that numbered 603,550 males above the age of 20 capable of serving in the army. The book begins with a census that numbered 603,550 males above the age of 20 capable of serving in the army. This number did not include the males of the tribe of Levi, because this tribe had been dedicated to the Lord's service with the tabernacle. Adding women, children, and those men who were not fit for military duty, and the total number of the Israelite nation has been estimated between 2 and 3 million people. This explains why chapters 2, 3, and 4 outline in detail how the camp was organized. Every detail was assigned with military precision, which was necessary in handling such a vast number of people. Now, the journey from Mount Sinai to the Promised Land should have taken approximately 2 weeks, but 3 days into the journey, in chapter 11, the people begin to complain. God was blessing them with a daily portion of manna, but this was not good enough. They longed for meat and other foods that they ate while slaves in Egypt. God responded to their ingratitude, first with a fire that consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. Then he sent quail, more than they could eat, and many of those who complained died from a plague. In the midst of this incident, Moses comes unglued. In chapter 10, verses 10 through 15, Moses unleashes a classic rant to God. The weight of leadership is overwhelming him. He's exhausted from the strain of leading these people, and the whining and complaining is the straw that broke the camel's back. Moses has had enough. He's dealt with this one too many times. First, when he went before Pharaoh and demanded that he let the people go, Pharaoh made their forced labor more difficult by requiring them to find their own straw for brickmaking. And what did the Israelites do? They turned on Moses and said, "May the Lord judge you for making our situation worse." And yet, God still delivered them through 10 miraculous plagues. Then when they left Egypt and came to the Red Sea with Pharaoh's army in hot pursuit, what did the Israelites do? They turned on Moses and said it would be better to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. And yet God parted the Red Sea and destroyed Pharaoh's army. As they journeyed to Mount Sinai, they grumbled about a lack of food, and God sent them manna and quail. And then they complained about a lack of water, threatening to stone Moses. And then God brought forth water from a rock. And despite all of God's miraculous interventions on their behalf, at Mount Sinai, while Moses is on the mount receiving God's law, the people craft a golden calf to worship. Is it any wonder that by Numbers chapter 10, Moses is at the end of his rope? But once again, God comes through. He instructs Moses to select 70 leaders from the Israelite community. God would place upon these 70 leaders the same spirit that he had placed on Moses. These 70 leaders would help Moses bear the burden of this vast nation, so that Moses would not carry it alone. There's an old saying that goes like this: there is strength in numbers. It was true for Moses, and it's true for us today. Moses desperately needed support and encouragement, otherwise the weight of leadership would crush him. Today, Christians desperately need support and encouragement. That's why in Class 101, we're upfront about the fact that we expect those who call GNG their church home to attend Sunday services as often as possible. Why? Because there's strength in numbers. It's an encouragement to the entire church family when we all gather together for worship. And that's why in Class 201, we're honest about the fact that we expect every member to be in a life group or a task group. Each of us desperately needs support and encouragement. Otherwise, the weight of life and the pressure of sin will crush us. Trust me, if Moses couldn't handle it on his own, neither can we. You know, I believe God gave Moses these 70 leaders because he knew Moses' toughest leadership tests were coming. Moses was about to face direct assaults upon his leadership and his authority, and they began within his own family. In chapter 12, Moses' sister Miriam and his brother Aaron began to criticize Moses because he married a Cushite woman. Now, Bible scholars have proposed a number of explanations for what's happening in this story. Some believe that Moses' first wife, Zipporah, must have died because she was a Midianite, not a Cushite. Moses, therefore, must have remarried. Some believe Miriam and Aaron opposed this marriage because Moses' wife was not an Israelite. More recently, some commentators have suggested that Cush is associated with Ethiopia, and thus Moses' marriage was interracial. Some scholars believe that Miriam and Aaron felt Moses' wife exerted too great an influence on Moses in his selection of the 70 leaders upon whom the Spirit of God would rest. They wanted a greater hand in selecting the 70 leaders. This might explain Miriam's statement, "Has the Lord spoken only through Moses? Hasn't he also spoken through us?" Others believe that it was nothing more than a private falling out between Miriam and Moses' wife, as so often happens among in-laws. Whatever it was that drove Miriam and Aaron to do this, the bottom line is that they envied Moses' special position as God's man for that moment in time. Perhaps they simply camouflaged the real issue, their jealousy of his position, by focusing attention on his wife. In any event, God's reaction was swift and sure. Miriam is struck with leprosy. But why didn't Aaron get punished as well? That's a great question, and one to which the Bible is unclear. Some have suggested that Miriam was the instigator of this whole affair. Others believe God spared Aaron because his reaction to his sister's punishment indicates true remorse. This event puts the interplay of God's justice and mercy on full display. Miriam is healed, but she is forced to remain outside the camp for 7 days due to her ceremonial uncleanness. Then in chapters 13 and 14, Moses leads the nation to the edge of the promised land. 12 spies are sent to scout out the land, but 10 return with a report that demoralizes the people. Despite God's miraculous interventions, the people refuse to enter the promised land, believing it to be unconquerable. I can't begin to imagine the depth of Moses' disappointment. All of his leadership skill and ability, combined with God's guidance and miraculous acts, had brought the people to the edge of the land God promised over 500 years before to Abraham, and the people say, "We don't believe the land could be taken." How heartbreaking that must have been. And God sentences them to wander in the wilderness until every man 20 years old and up, except Joshua and Caleb, had died. In chapter 15, considerable attention is given to unintentional and intentional sins. Remember, the Israelites now understand that they will wander in the wilderness for a considerable length of time. The promised land is now out of reach for the vast majority of them. Thus, the inclination to become lax about their relationship with God or to openly defy Him could be strong. The original word for unintentional used in chapters 15, verse 22, meant wandering away, as a sheep might wander away from the rest of the flock. It implied sin that stemmed from human weakness rather than outright rebellion or premeditated evil. The ceremonial observances were so numerous and so various that one might easily overlook or forget to observe them, especially as time dragged on. So offerings were delineated to atone for the sins. But verse 30 through 36 addresses intentional, or in the NIV version, defiant sin. This word defiant literally means to sin with a high hand, as though one is raising a clenched fist in defiance of God. This is a blatant disregard of God's commands. This passage goes on to give an example of a person who clenched his fist at God. We look at the offense of picking up sticks on the Sabbath, and we assume this is no big deal. The guy's probably collecting firewood or stakes for his tent. But the context makes it clear that this wasn't a mistake or a moment of forgetfulness. This guy was well aware of the Sabbath commands laid down in Exodus 31, 12 through 17, and Exodus 35, 1 through 3. God clearly spelled out the penalty for breaking the Sabbath, and that penalty was death. This guy's action was a direct, intentional assault on God's law, a shaking of his fist at God. His stoning dramatically illustrated to the entire Israelite community that God meant business. Those who sin defiantly pay with their lives. Now, some today believe that stories like this are proof that the God of the Old Testament is harsh and vengeful, while the God of the New Testament is loving and merciful. The God of the Old Testament demands bloody animal sacrifices and death for violators of his laws, while the God of the New Testament is forgiving and kind. These people forget that God never changes. The same God is the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. We would do well to remember that the New Testament centers around the ultimate bloody sacrifice, not of a lamb, goat, bull, or pigeon, but of God's Son, the God-man, Jesus, who died on a cruel cross for the sins of the world. His sacrifice put an end to the need for continued animal sacrifices. His blood covers the sins of the world. And we would do well to remember that at the inception of the church, similar to the inception of the Israelite nation, those who shook their fist at God, who sinned defiantly, met a swift end. Read Acts chapter 5, verses 1 through 11 for the story of Ananias and Sapphira, and ask yourself if the God of the New Testament didn't still mean business. This man's actions could have become an example to the entire Israelite nation that open defiance of God's law was no big deal. Ananias and Sapphira's bold-faced lie to the entire church could have become an example to the church that appearing generous trumps being generous, and God wasn't having any of it. But knowing you're doomed to 40 years in the wilderness, and knowing that if you're a man over the age of 20 and your name isn't Joshua or Caleb, you're never going to get see that promised land, it's tough stuff. And in chapter 16, Moses experiences an open rebellion. This rebellion was led by a man named Korah, a member of Moses' own tribe, the Levites. But this rebellion involved members of the tribe of Reuben and 250 well-known community leaders. They charged that Moses and Aaron had abused their spiritual leadership. Since all of God's people are holy, they claimed Moses and Aaron had no special authority to lead Israel. Korah was of the Levite clan of Kohath, the clan responsible for transporting the sacred items in the tabernacle like the Ark of the Covenant. Thus his clan ranked just below the priests, but that apparently wasn't good enough for Korah. In verses 8 through 11, Moses tries to remind Korah of his honored position, the privilege it is to serve God by working with the tabernacle. But Korah refuses to budge. He wants a more prominent and public role. How many times do we see this very same thing in the church today? God blesses an individual with a tremendous gift for service and a ministry that impacts people's lives. But they waste that gift and undermine the effectiveness of their ministry because they are not satisfied with what they have. They devalue their own calling while coveting someone else's gift or ministry. And the result, in this particular case, was catastrophic. Korah and his followers were swallowed up by the earth, and the 250 community leaders were destroyed by fire. Oddly enough, despite this awful display of God's judgment, the very next day, the Israelites grumbled that Moses and Aaron were responsible for killing God's people. How ironic. Their refusal to see the truth may indicate how embedded Korah's rebellion had become. And God unleashed a plague that destroyed over 14,000 of the Israelites. Now this brings us to the last and perhaps most tragic story that I want to cover from Numbers. It's found in chapter 20. Once again, the Israelites are grumbling about a lack of water. Problem is, this is a whole new band of whiners. You see, there's a gap of nearly 40 years between chapters 19 and 20. So the incident with Korah is now a distant memory. Moses and Aaron seek God's guidance, and he specifically instructs them as to how to obtain water from a rock. Moses gathers the people and then fails to act as God instructed. As a result, God tells them that neither of them, neither Moses nor Aaron, will enter the promised land. This seems incredibly harsh for a man who had faithfully served God under extreme conditions for 40 years. Who in their right mind would put up with all the grumbling, complaining, and rebellions like Moses did? And then to be told you can't enter the promised land. How does this make any sense at all? I think we might find a clue in what God said. He said to Moses and Aaron in chapter 20, verse 12, "Because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them." Notice he says, "Because you did not trust in me enough." Perhaps what happened in this case is that Moses' faith had wavered. Or perhaps he did not trust that a mere word was enough to bring water out of the rock, as God had instructed. Instead, he hit the rock twice with his staff, and he did this in front of all the people. But God not only said, "Because you did not trust in me enough," he also said, "to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites." Moses appears in this story to be taking credit for the miracle when he says, "Must we," referring to himself and Aaron, "bring water out of this rock?" So he fails to give God the credit for the miracle. And the Lord showed himself to be holy in this incident. By judging Moses and Aaron for their sin, even though they were his chosen leaders, God demonstrated that there would be no compromise, no favoritism, and no exceptions for sin. But once again, though his justice was on full display, so was his mercy. Water was provided from the rock for the people. Interestingly, scholars believe that Miriam, Aaron, and Moses all died in the same year, 40 years after the Exodus from Egypt. Moses' farewell address is contained in the next book, the book of Deuteronomy. Now, friends, I hope this has been a helpful overview of some of the more interesting stories in the book of Numbers. And I pray that you are continuing with the daily Bible readings, that you're watching the videos, and that you're getting a lot out of this study of God's Word. Friends, as always, until next time, think biblically, think logically, and think honestly.
See you next week.